You may proceed.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court. At this time, I request to reserve 5 minutes rebuttal.
All right.
The Commonwealth has looked at various iterations of why the trial court should be affirmed, but I think the case boils down to the concurrence opinion of the Court of Appeals, the question that concurrence raises. Obviously, I disagree with the conclusion of that decision, but the question it raises, could Shiflett have been asked, have you been convicted of perjury, appears to be the dispositive question in this matter once we go through these various iterations. And that question boils down simply to what has and has not been preserved from common law. Subordination of perjury is a separate and distinct statute. It has never been subsumed under basically principle and second degree law that's existed in the past 100 years. It stands separate and apart from perjury, as it did in common law. It's been made very clear with a few tweaks of what the punishment is. It is separate and distinct in two different statutes. But yet, at the same time, the laws of evidence during that same time, during the past 100 years, as the court has seen, as the citation from Friend on Evidence, has gone through very many changes and iterations. Most prominently, of course, the statute that's at issue here, which is 19.2-296, which codifies that transition. If we go back to common law, both in general but in Virginia in particular, there were sort of three different categories. We had felonies, we had perjury, and we had this general doctrine, which I was refreshed, my recollection was refreshed in this case, crimen falsi. And of course, crimen falsi was a mishmash of various bad things you could do. It included subornation, arguably included perjury, bribery, and various other things. That common law rule has been changed in Virginia. The modern iteration, of course, is the question, have you been convicted of a misdemeanor involving moral turpitude, as decided by this court in Payne versus Carroll. That is the modern iteration of that old common law rule about impeachment for moral turpitude. That is the limit. That is the limit as to what a person can be asked for any crime with the exception of perjury. The statute says perjury, singular, as a rule of impeachment. It does not say perjuries. It does not have the broad language of the Federal Rules of Evidence, Rule 609, which talks about general fraudulent statements. If we were in federal court, Galen Shiflett could have been asked this question under that broader interpretation, which our federal colleagues have chosen to make broad. Yet Virginia has narrowed down since common law what the rule is for impeachment.
If you look at this sort of from way back, broad picture, what you're arguing about is this specific narrow issue with regard to two felonies, when you just made the point that the whole doctrine on lying, cheating, or stealing is with regard to a misdemeanor conviction. Point being, admitting to two felonies or a felony is bad enough. We don't need to know what it is, right? In the world of harmless error, why does this matter?
So just to clarify, ma'am, is Your Honor's question that it would be harmless error that a person was questioned whether they were convicted of a felony as opposed to moral turpitude, and if moral turpitude would be on the same level as felony?
Well, what I'm saying is, if you look at historically why we have this rule about what you can ask with regard to misdemeanors, then aren't we saying if you're convicted of a felony, it doesn't make any difference for purposes of character
it,
what kind of felony it was.
The question can be raised, and the trier of fact, in this case a jury, can determine whether convicted of two felonies. And, of course, in this case it was hit and run, and not the most egregious felony, but still conceivably a felony. And, of course, the salient one here, subornation of perjury. The trier of fact could determine whether felony, without naming it, is bad, and this person, and will take with a grain of salt this witness when they testify. But we can't look on the record and say, therefore, oh, he's a felon, so therefore we're going to believe him less than the question which was specifically asked, which is, have you been convicted of a moral turpitude crime of lying, cheating, or stealing? We don't know whether the trial court said, oh, well, I don't believe him because he was convicted of lying, cheating, and stealing, more so than general undefined felony.
What difference does that make?
It makes a difference because he was asked a question which could not have been asked.
Well, why can't it be asked?
Because again, he could have been asked, have you been convicted of felony, and if so, how many?
Right. But if it had to do with a misdemeanor, he certainly could have been asked whether or not it involved moral turpitude.
Yes.
Why do you think there's a distinction between the two rules, between felonies and misdemeanors?
I think it is because, frankly, I'll just reveal, I went back and for the first time in my career I read Blackstone and Wigmore on this case. And what I came up was not sort of pro-appellant or pro-appellee, but that historically it was a mishmash. And in clarifying what the law is in modern times, that is a decision Virginia has made to say we are only going to look at misdemeanors involving moral turpitude, but we're going to ask general felonies.
And yeah, but I think what we've said in our case is it's because at common law, all felonies were considered to be infamous or crimes of moral turpitude.
Yes.
So that's the reason why you don't have to say with the felony involved moral turpitude. It's because we've said that at common law, those convicted of felonies were guilty of crimes involving, quote, moral turpitude and were excluded from being witnesses.
And I think the key thing is infamous crimes. That is, you know, of course, in common law, they'd only be witnesses long enough to either be executed or sent to Australia, for lack of a better description. The fact remains that felonies, of course, have been expanded in the meantime. That's one modern factor. Felonies used to be much more restricted back at common law, and hence were a close set of infamous crimes. There are a lot more felonies these days. That's one major distinction. But the other distinction, again, is we have made a policy decision to limit what particular questions can be asked.
Assume for a moment that we didn't have a separate statute for suborning perjury, and somebody actually did what we call suborning perjury, wouldn't that person under Virginia law be guilty of perjury, nonetheless, as perjury as a second degree actor?
I would concede if the indictment, it is entirely conceivable that.
I'm talking about the indictment.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm talking about, is it possible, absent a statute, that you could do everything that suborning perjury anticipates and be nonetheless guilty as a principal in the second degree of perjury?
I was actually thinking to myself that very question. I cannot come to mind of committing subornation of perjury without being a principal in the second degree. But I can't sort of exclude every possible scenario.
Right. Well, so if
but you can't
look at,
think of any.
Right.
I'm not that creative, Your Honor.
So, for example, if somebody is the wheelman in a robbery, he's convicted of robbery.
Absolutely.
So he's convicted of robbery as a principal in the second degree. Why isn't subornation of perjury, in essence, perjury in the second degree?
Because we look to the common law, more so than any other state that I can think of. That is why sort of the touchstone is Code Section 1-200. We follow the common law unless it is expressly changed. And I think the issue of could my client have been charged with principal and second degree perjury, the key thing in impeachment law is
you're right on point here because I'm not sure we changed it. It says, the statute says, Any person procure or induce another to commit perjury or to give false testimony or oath in violation of any provision of this article, he shall be punished as prescribed in 18.2-434. And that's exactly what a principal in the second degree concept does. It punishes you exactly as the principal in the first degree and finds you guilty of that.
And the fact remains that we oftentimes track similar punishment. I use the example of conspiracy and distribution of narcotics. Two separate and distinct offenses. I've had clients charged with two separate and distinct offenses. If you look at the end of both those statutes, shall be punished as. Almost exactly the same language because we look at the penalty. And again, I talked in brief about that's the penalty. That is the punishment. But the laws of evidence is not punishment. It is assisting the trier of fact. If I could go back briefly to the hypothetical of could my client have been charged as principal in the second degree of perjury? And I think that's a good point. We do not sort of look back behind what people could have been convicted of. You know, there are plenty of folks who could have been convicted of a felony version of an offense, you know, stealing $199 versus $200. Very briefly, and I'll sit down, because this is important. We look at the charge of conviction for impeachment. Just because someone got a break and stole $400 and got convicted of misdemeanor, you can't retry and say, well, he should have been convicted of felony for purposes of impeachment.
You have 4 minutes and 15 seconds left.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Susan Harris, and I am here on behalf of the Commonwealth. This is a case about the propriety of impeaching a defendant witness with a conviction of suborning perjury. And as we have argued on appeal, we believe that it is subject to the perjury exception under 19.2269 in the same way that common law perjury under 18.2434 is. And that there's no reason, it's absolutely illogical when you consider what the purpose of impeachment is, that one could be impeached by a prior conviction of common law perjury, but not suborning perjury. That is because the reason that we allow impeachment at all is to test or gauge the capacity of the witness for truth and veracity. That is the objective of impeachment. When you have, and the reason that we, culture or society, have decided not to allow impeachment, and I'm speaking just as when the witness is a defendant witness, the rules are a little different for another kind of witness. I'm talking just about a defendant who elects to testify in his or her own defense. The reason that we don't allow willy-nilly prior convictions is because, as what read, we don't want a defendant testifying with a noose about his neck. That, you know, that's not the object. We are just interested, and we certainly don't want to.
What do you mean by that? That's interesting. Well, you don't want a defendant testifying as though they had a noose around their neck.
Yeah, coming to the stand and testifying, and you've already got the hangman's noose around your neck.
Because they've been convicted of something else?
Yes, sir. Because you've already,
The defendant, under those circumstances, the defendant himself could let the jury know what he was convicted of. You know, if he was convicted of a felony of discharge of apple cider into the Shenandoah River, which, by the way, occurred. Which is a felony. I mean, he could tell the jury, he could say, look, just so everybody knows here, I got convicted of putting apple cider in the Shenandoah River, so don't think this has anything to do with honesty.
Well,
so couldn't the defendant cure that problem?
Well, yes, but I'm saying the reason that the question is improper is because you can see that We don't want to give the fact finder the impression that this person is likely to have committed the crime upon which he's being tried that day. And, you know, it attenuates the presumption of innocence, of which we all come to when we are defendant in a case.
That point.
So that's
let me ask you this, though. I think it's interesting. From his argument, he seems to concede that without the statute, you could actually indict someone for a principal in the second degree of perjury for the same conduct and then get a conviction for perjury, and we wouldn't be here.
Well, that's a great point, and it's made on brief.
Right. So then the question that follows after that would be, why do we have a separate statute? Is it just a codification of common law, or is there something different about this statute?
Well, I would just say, that was pointed out on brief, that one of the commentators, I think Bassicle, makes the point that today there's no distinction really between a principal and then a suborner perjurer. So you're right. What are we doing here? We're here because, well, I believe that if it's not explicitly stated, it should be. Because, it's just simply illogical if you think about the purpose of impeachment. You are looking to attack or gauge the capacity of a witness's truth and veracity, and that's what perjury does. It's uniquely probative of a witness's capacity for truth and veracity. It doesn't, you know, say if naming a felony of a capital murder, if that was on somebody. That's not as uniquely probative of a person's capacity for veracity in the same way that perjury is. And that's why, again,
Justice Goodwin pointed out, at common law, the fact that it was a felony was a comment on your character. And that's why the impeachment was allowed, even though you couldn't name it. But in any event, let me ask you a separate question. Under 18.2-434, there's the additional part of the statute. Upon the conviction of any person for perjury, such person thereby shall be adjudged forever incapable of holding any office of honor, profit, or trust under the Constitution of Virginia or of serving as a jury.
Yes, sir.
A juror, excuse me. Is it the Commonwealth's position that if you are actually convicted under 436, that those disabilities act as a punishment that they suffer as well?
Yes, sir.
It is?
Yes, sir.
Now, I can't figure out a reason for the statute, then.
Well,
because a principal in the second degree would give you everything that 434 provides.
I mean, if you're saying that the General Assembly could have more efficiently crafted the perjury statutes, I mean, you might be right about that. But, you know, that's different. That issue is different from what we're here before the court today. What the defendant is arguing is because they are in two separate places, that must mean that you can impeach as to one and not the other. And as I say, our position is that is just illogical, considering the reason that we allow impeachment of defendant witnesses and, how perjury, as I say, is uniquely probative of a person's capacity for veracity. In the way of conviction for capital murder, it's not. So those are the points that I wanted to make, and unless there are any questions, I'll stand down.
Thank you. We have 4 minutes and 15 seconds.
Thank you, sir. I think the best summary, just going back to the basics, why perjury stands alone is actually a quote from Lambert Judge Humphrey's concurring opinion. Perjury constitutes a uniquely probative evidence in the rules governing impeachment of witnesses. And you're never going to see the why in that sentence. But I think the why is sort of a pattern and practice that we oftentimes use in evidence. What is this person's pattern and practice? My pattern and practice is showing up to the office at 8 or 9. that person's pattern of practice, that individual person's pattern of practice, is raising their right hand and just having utter disdain for the oath that they made. And that is separate and distinct from any other moral turpitude offense. A person can cheat on their taxes, they can lie to a federal official, they can forge a million checks.
But let me stop you right there, because in this particular instance, the court did not allow the Commonwealth to state the crime that the person was charged with.
Yes. Well,
right.
they said...
Isn't that correct?
After much iterations and things like that, they said, were you convicted of a crime of moral turpitude such as lying, cheating, or stealing?
A felony of moral turpitude.
I'm sorry?
A felony.
Yes.
Right.
Directly contrary, of course, to Payne versus Carroll. So for the harmless error analysis...
But you say directly contrary to Payne versus Carroll. But Payne... Okay, go ahead.
Okay.
Go ahead.
I felt a little hectic just as I was running down with the clock, but I hope I wanted to make very clear this thing. We do not look back at what the person could have been convicted of. So if I dumped apple cider in the Shenandoah River, never done it, I had the opportunity, I guess, but and it was reduced to a misdemeanor, if I were testifying, you could not go back and say, well, you could have been convicted of a felony, such as you could have been convicted of perjury in the second degree. We look at the offense as convicted, and the offense as convicted is not perjury. It's a common law, separate and distinct offense, as noted in Mundy in that regard.
Even if the court was in error in allowing the question, how could it possibly be harmful in this instance?
I'm not sure. Is that as to Justice McClanahan's question about felony versus moral turpitude, or factually?
Well, factually. In this particular instance, and felony as opposed to a misdemeanor involving moral turpitude, knowing that the felony involved moral turpitude, how could that ever be harmful?
Because, again, you could not have been asked. You could only have
but
been
the
asked.
Reason, yeah. What you say could yeah. not have been asked, but why do you think it could not have been asked?
Because this is always a balancing act as to any time you raise a felony. People can be innocent of heinous crimes and be convicted of felonies. People can testify truthfully and be convicted of felonies in that regard. We are always doing a balancing
test. That's true, but we allow the fact that they are convicted of a felony to be allowed in evidence because at common law, felonies involve moral turpitude. And we said in Harmon that the reason why we don't allow details or evidence concerning the nature of a crime is because it might mean more to a jury than the mere fact that the person is of doubtful veracity.
Well, I think
because it might go to something other than veracity.
Yes, and
in this particular instance, the additional information that was asked, how could it go to anything other than veracity?
Because again, felonies at common law were so restricted. That is, they were punishable by death. So many more things are felonies.
Let me ask, how could this have affected your client in any manner other than going to his credibility? It seems like to me it might even have helped him, given the felony he was being charged with.
Actually, I think, you know, Lord knows how it may have affected his sentencing. But again, it's a swearing contest. This is as close as you get to pure credibility tests.
Exactly. And that's why we're allowed to state someone has been convicted of a felony, because it does affect their credibility. Finding that the felony involved moral turpitude, as best I can tell, doesn't make him any more likely to have committed the crime. It's just another additional evidence of their concerning their credibility, isn't it?
It adds on. It in effect piles on as to credibility tests, and especially with a jury as the trier of fact, we can't tell whether there was harmless error in this case.
But what would the error? I mean, I guess I'm trying to understand what is the prejudice. You just. What is the prejudice that you would claim? Because it's going to veracity, right?
Yes.
And we're allowed to impeach their veracity with the felony. So providing this additional information about the felony, how could that have caused any increased
prejudice? Have you been convicted of a felony? Which could be hit and run, it could be apple cider.
They were charged with here.
Yeah. Or have you been convicted of a felony involving moral turpitude a little bit further? Have you been convicted of a felony involving perjury a little bit further? Again, that is more information.
But we allow that information concerning misdemeanors.
That is just, frankly, a legacy of crimen falsi, from the common law.
And also in our rule, we allow that, and then right after that we said, but you can say that a misdemeanor involves moral turpitude, but you can't talk about the details or the nature of the crime. So implicit in that, doesn't that mean that saying whether or not a crime involves moral turpitude deals neither with the nature nor the details of the crime?
I'm sorry, the felony?
Yeah.
Okay.
It doesn't deal with the nature or the details of the crime.
Well, once you get into the lying, cheating, or stealing category, the credibility bell has been rung, as it were, and you don't need to go into any much more details. And that's a little bit more extreme than a generic felony, which he was asked about.
Even though we allow it with misdemeanors?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
All right, your time has expired. The court will be in recess until 9 o'clock tomorrow morning.
All rise.